U.S. going to walk away from NATO? Are we in this on our own?
What is happening with Greenland, and what could President Trump's demands mean for U.S. allies?
For Thursday, January 22nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The killing of Renee Macklin Good by an immigration enforcement officer in Minneapolis has raised questions about the use of deadly force.
We look back at the 1992 standoff that drove a federal policy change.
So it actually restricted when you could use deadly force because you were elevating and honoring human life.
And when the Trump administration slashed foreign aid last year, a key HIV vaccine trial stopped.
But researchers didn't give up.
This is a great opportunity for South Africa to prove that we can do things in South Africa for South Africa with South African financing.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. A five-year-old boy was taken by ICE agents in Minnesota and is now in federal custody in Texas. NPR's Sarah Ventry reports he's the fourth child detained from the same school district over the last few weeks.
The child, Liam Conejo Ramos, was taken from a running car in the family's driveway when federal immigration agents came to arrest his father. That's according to Zena Stenvik, the Columbia Heights Public Schools superintendent, the district where the boy is a student. She claims the child was used as bait to bring his family members out of their home. In a post on X, DHS says the child was abandoned by his parents, and that's why he was taken. They've confirmed that both the child and his father are being held at the Dilley Detention Center outside of San Antonio in Texas. DHS continues to say that it's taking dangerous criminals off the streets of Minneapolis and that its officers have made over 3,000 arrests in the last 6 weeks. Sarah Ventry, NPR News, Minneapolis.
Former special counsel Jack Smith defended his investigations of President Trump as he fielded questions from congressional Republicans today, NPR's Kerry Johnson reports.
Jack Smith presided over two criminal indictments of Trump for attempting to overturn the 2020 election and for hiding secret documents at his Florida resort. Neither case got to a jury before Trump returned to the White House last year. Smith says he had proof beyond a reasonable doubt in both cases and that he was not motivated by politics. He says if he had any regrets, it was not expressing enough support for the prosecutors and FBI agents who worked on the cases. Many of those public servants have been fired by the Trump administration. Some have faced threats, he says, for doing their jobs. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is suing J.P. Morgan Chase and its CEO, Jamie Dimon, alleging that the country's biggest bank closed his accounts for political reasons after the January 6th Capitol riot. NPR's Maria Aspen reports.
The president is seeking $5 billion in damages. He alleges that J.P. Morgan Chase closed his accounts in 2021 after the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol as a result of, quote, political and social motivations. A J.P. Morgan Chase spokesperson tells NPR via email that the lawsuit has no merit and that the bank, quote, does not close accounts for political or religious reasons. Trump has attacked several big banks over what he calls debanking conservatives. Last year, he sued Capital One over similar allegations. And in August, he issued an executive order targeting what he calls politicized or unlawful debanking. Banks have said they close accounts due to legal and regulatory risks. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
The Olympic flame is making its way through Venice, gliding on boats down the Grand Canal. The opening ceremony for the Milan Cortina Games is February 6th. This is NPR News. The Food and Drug Administration is weighing whether to allow new advertising messages about Zyn nicotine pouches. Philip Morris is asked to begin promoting Zyn as a less harmful alternative for adult smokers. Studies submitted by the company suggest that switching to Zyn can lower the risks of lung cancer, stroke, and other smoking-related ailments. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has lifted its public health emergency for Mpox, formerly called monkeypox. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel reports.
Africa CDC initially declared Mpox a health emergency in August 2024, the first time the health agency of the African Union had declared an emergency. It happened just as a new strain of the virus was emerging in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Jean Kaseya is the director general of Africa CDC and says in the last 6 weeks, Mpox cases have dropped 90% to 140 cases last week. But he cautions the disease is still circulating.
Lifting the status of public health emergency of concern security doesn't mean that mpox is eliminated. It means we are considering mpox as a disease we need to control.
Kaseya says his team will continue to support countries that are dealing with mpox outbreaks. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
Rhode Island may be ditching its Mr. Potato Head specialty license plates. The anthropomorphic legume's owner, Hasbro, is moving its headquarters from the Ocean State to Boston, prompting lawmakers to propose ending the plates. They were first issued in 2002 to mark the toy's 50th anniversary. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. Programming is supported in part by University of Minnesota Extension, hosting woodland stewards from across Minnesota at the Minnesota Family Woodlands Conference, March 13th and 14th at St. John's University in Collegeville, teaching attendees practical ways to care for your woods and connect with others who are doing the same. More information on Facebook at My Minnesota Woods. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly with a question that has dominated the week both here and across the globe. Do we know what's happening with Greenland? For weeks, President Trump has made plain he wants the United States to own the Arctic island. He threatened military action. He also threatened tariffs on U.S. allies, all to get his way. President Trump appears to have backed off those threats for now. By the end of the day yesterday, speaking from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, President Trump said he had reached a framework for a deal on Greenland. What is it? And how exactly was this deal reached? Questions I put to Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and reporter Willem Marks on NPR's weekly national security podcast, Sources and Methods. So, Willem, what do we know about this deal, this framework of a deal?
I'm going to disappoint you, Mary Louise. We don't know a lot for sure in terms of confirmed information from public sources.
The U.S. does not own Greenland that we know of at this hour.
Not yet, not yet. There may be conversations about that down the road. It's not clear. It seems like there have been these very, very key discussions between President Trump and a man called Mark Rutte, who is the Secretary General of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. He's a former Dutch Prime Minister. I have a Dutch passport. I've known the guy for years. He's very charming, very glib, and very astute politically. Mm-hmm. He stayed on top of a coalition in the Netherlands for a long time. And those skills have been brought to bear, not for the first time, with President Trump this week. The discussions seem to have unlocked some of the US president's concerns about the role that Greenland would play in Arctic security. And Rutte, on behalf of NATO at least, seems to have made some sorts of assurances about security efforts, potentially security expenditure, and security access for the US in that North Atlantic massive island as Greenland is.
So Rutte has somehow managed to back us up from the precipice for now. We have not seen the end of NATO, the alliance he leads, this week. But I mean, I'll point out the obvious, which is that NATO is not Greenland. NATO is not Denmark, and Greenland is part of Denmark. Were Danish officials involved in these conversations? Are they on board with whatever has been agreed?
That is a very delicate question. There was no one from Denmark or their delegation in the room with Rutte and Trump. The Danish have made very clear that Rutte does not speak on behalf of them, even though he speaks on behalf of an alliance to which they're members. In fact, you know, we've heard from the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, since this announcement that they can't negotiate on their sovereignty. And in fact, the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has been meeting with the British Prime Minister in the UK, presumably for conversations about this pretty exclusively. Very grateful that the UK and others stood with Denmark over the last couple of weeks after we heard those initial threats from President Trump. But it's pretty clear from what we've heard both from Danish officials and Greenlandic officials over the last few hours that essentially they haven't been that closely involved in any of these conversations. but they look forward to having further conversations with the US side in the days and weeks to come.
Tom Bowman, what are you hearing from sources here in the States?
Well, as far as this so-called framework, I talked to a European official. He said one of the things they're looking at is providing the U.S. with another U.S. military base or bases in Greenland. Of course, they have one there now that does early warning and also operates satellites. And Trump importantly mentioned the Golden Dome, his missile defense system. So it's possible that this additional base or another extra bases could be used for Golden Dome. You could have interceptor missiles there or some high-tech equipment and so forth and so on. Now, there are reports that, well, right now with the current base there, it flies the Danish flag. It's Denmark has sovereignty over it.
Okay.
The reports what the U.S. wants is if we can't have all of Greenland, just give us a little piece so we can put this base or other bases there.
So there is a U.S.
Correct.
Flag flying somewhere.
And as
Greenland.
Willem pointed out, the Danish Prime Minister Frederiksen said sovereignty is non-negotiable. It's not going to happen. And again, the people we all talk with say, what's the future of NATO? Is the U.S. going to walk away from NATO? Are we in this on our own? I think those are the serious questions.
And you don't
I think.
Feel like we got an answer to that this
I don't
week.
Think we got an
not,
answer
not
to that.
Not a definitive one.
No.
It's NPR's Tom Bowman and reporter Willem Marks in Davos speaking with me on Sources and Methods, NPR's weekly national security podcast. You can hear more of our conversation wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in 1992, federal agents surrounded the home of a U.S. citizen in Idaho. What happened next not only shocked the nation, but it drove a change in federal policy when it came to the use of deadly force. And now, some three decades later, there are once again questions about agents' use of deadly force after an immigration enforcement officer fatally shot Renee Macklin Good in Minneapolis. For more on what happened in 1992 and why it's so relevant today, we're joined by NPR's domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Odette, remind us what happened in northern Idaho all those years ago.
Right. Well, the incident is often referred to as Ruby Ridge, and it involved a man named Randall Weaver and his family. Federal agents were after Weaver for not showing up to court in a case where he was charged with selling two sawed-off shotguns to an undercover ATF agent. And things culminated over 2 days in August that year. Armed federal agents were stationed around Weaver's cabin in the woods, and they'd been given orders for that mission to shoot any armed adult male. And in the end, three people died: a deputy U.S. Marshal, Weaver's 14-year-old son, and Weaver's wife. And of course, none of them were the intended target of the operation. And so this affair became a seminal moment for the far right. It was representative of fears around federal government overreach, lawlessness, and abuse of power.
And how did this incident end up shifting federal policy?
Well, initially it didn't. The immediate assessment of the FBI was that it was a job well done. But that didn't quiet public concern. And so ultimately, there was a tremendous reevaluation, not only of the specifics of the standoff, but also the institutional factors that made it possible. And 3 years later, the Department of Justice issued its first ever written, uniform, and department-wide policy on the use of deadly force. Here's then Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick sharing the new policy during a Senate subcommittee hearing.
Under the new policy, law enforcement and corrections officers may use deadly force only when the officer has a reasonable belief that the subject of such force poses an imminent danger of death or serious physical injury to the officer or another person. Deadly force may not be used if an alternative reasonably appears to be sufficient to accomplish the law enforcement purpose.
And that qualification at the end there, Juana, that there has to be no reasonable alternative to deadly force, is notable.
What's significant about that?
Well, I spoke to John Cox about this. He's a retired FBI agent who started at the agency just a few months after the new policy took effect.
So it actually restricted when you could use deadly force in accordance with the policy, because you were elevating and honoring human life, and that's what you were trying to preserve. So there were instances where maybe constitutionally you could use deadly force, but the policy said no.
Now, in the context of the Minneapolis incident, there's been no meaningful scrutiny so far of whether the officer had a reasonable alternative to deadly force. And that may be because immigration enforcement falls under a completely different department, the Department of Homeland Security, which does not require a no safe alternative provision.
And how might things be different if the Department of Homeland Security's policy did require this idea of no safe alternative that we're talking about?
Well, Cox said that that standard might prompt questions about why the officer stood in front of Macklin Good's car and whether stepping out of the way would have changed the risk to the agent and others. But, you know, to me, Juana, reporting on extremism, it's interesting that the DOJ established its standard as a result of a standoff in 1992 with the Weaver family, which held far-right, anti-government, white separatist beliefs.
How so?
You know, Weaver believed that he was set up by federal agents because he had refused to become an informant for them. He said they were trying to recruit him to help them infiltrate Aryan Nations, which was an Idaho-based neo-Nazi organization. Weaver had attended a handful of their conferences. And at congressional subcommittee hearings 3 years later, you know, some legislators had pointed questions for him about whether he had items like with swastikas in his home, for example. But that did not seem to affect an apparent bipartisan consensus that something had gone very seriously wrong in that operation. In the Minneapolis incident, it's quite different. You know, this administration at the outset characterized Macklin Good's activities at the scene as domestic terrorism, even before the facts were fully known. And so there's clearly no bipartisan consensus that there should be some examination of the underlying policies that factored into what happened there.
NPR's Odette Youssef, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology.
On today's date, January 22nd, 2004, I have the unique opportunity to watch a northern goshawk as it sits quietly on a branch, perhaps waiting for its next meal. The goshawk is one of the largest accipitors in the Northland and is a very efficient predator, especially for ruffed grouse. The goshawk will outfly a ruffed grouse, if you can believe that. They're faster and as maneuverable as ruffed grouse, and oftentimes will overtake them on the wing and take them down and turn them into food. And though it might take them more than a day to eat a bird that size, they're perfectly willing to hang around and consume a ruffed grouse if they're capable of taking one down. And oftentimes you will find the results, area of scattered feathers along with a bit of scat from the goshawk as it consumes its prey. And if you're lucky enough to see a goshawk this time of year, enjoy the sight.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For four decades, researchers around the world have been trying to develop a vaccine for HIV without any luck. Recently, though, there has been some good news. Linda Gail Becker directs the Desmond Tutu Health Foundation in South Africa.
The last 5-10 years has really shone a light on what is needed for an effective vaccine. So it's an incredibly exciting time.
Well, one vaccine trial was hoping to build off of that excitement. It was supposed to launch a year ago across a handful of countries in Africa where AIDS has hit especially hard. But then suddenly, everything came to a stop. Reporter Ari Daniel has this story.
Penny Moore leads me into a room at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases in Johannesburg. It's arrayed with half a dozen large green and white freezers.
These are the freezers that contain the samples that are the basis of everything we do in the lab.
Moore is a virologist at the University of Witwatersrand. She cracks open the lid of one of the freezers and pulls out a tower of frosty tubes.
It's heavy and hard for me to lift. So this is blood and cells.
All samples that have been donated over and over again for 2 decades by the same group of 117 South African women.
They live in the communities that are most ravaged by HIV, and they donate their samples because they hope to see an end to an epidemic that is really, really real for them.
These samples have helped Moore and her team piece together a detailed portrait of the virus over the years, how it infects, how it hides, and how much it changes across different parts of the world and even within a single individual.
The amount we have learned from these freezers, it's just astonishing.
And yet Moore spent much of last year worrying that it might all amount to nothing, because just when she and her colleagues were on the brink of something audacious, an innovative HIV vaccine trial across Africa, the bottom dropped out. To explain, let me rewind to early last year to a meeting in Zanzibar.
The famous Zanzibar trip.
Zanzibar is a tropical archipelago off the east coast of Africa. Penny Moore says it was crazy hot.
One of those places where you just consider standing up and you break out in a sweat.
The gathering took place in a hotel perched on the edge of a brilliant blue ocean. There were researchers and clinicians from across Africa, and then there were the international scientific advisors.
They grueled us to within an inch of our lives to make sure that we were doing the very best cutting-edge science we could do with the amount of money we had.
That amount was $45 million awarded by the United States Agency for International Development to create a state-of-the-art vaccine to prevent HIV. The grant was intended to get teams across the continent to collaborate on developing a vaccine that would work in different African communities.
The virus that they have in Kenya is not the same as the virus that we have in Botswana. It's not the same as the virus that they have in Senegal. And so understanding how these vaccines will work for the local virus is what makes it relevant.
At the meeting in Zanzibar, there was a real feeling of momentum.
The excitement was through the roof.
This is Penny Moore's colleague, Nono Mkize.
We were at the beginning of something big.
But just as the meeting was about to wrap up, Penny Moore says the mood darkened.
From the number of Americans particularly checking their phones all of a sudden and talking to one another in little huddles.
Something was wrong. Newly inaugurated President Trump had just signed an executive order freezing all foreign aid. Suddenly, it seemed, everything was up in the air.
I remember at the end of the meeting, a USAID colleague saying to me, I'm not sure if I'll see you again. I completely underestimated how much it would gut the program.
But Moore and her colleagues would soon find out. After returning to Johannesburg, she says the official stop work orders arrived from Washington. Just weeks before the trials were to begin, everything came to a sudden halt. All the money, was gone.
In many ways, we've kind of had our legs cut off even as we're beginning to run the sprint.
Infectious disease specialist Linda Gale Becker is based at the University of Cape Town. When the funding collapsed, she says she cycled through the stages of grief.
There's disbelief in the first instance. Then there is emotion that basically is angry because we'd worked damn hard. We'd won this grant and we were doing what we had said we would do.
But gradually, Becker and her colleagues started saying,
"This matters too much to not finish the work."
A period of frantic grant writing began.
We brought out the begging bowl to say, "This is important. Can you help us in some way?"
Finally, they got funding from the South African Medical Research Council and the Gates Foundation, but it was a fraction of the original USAID grant and only focused inside South Africa, meaning they had to sacrifice studying how the vaccine might work against different versions of the virus within different African populations. Penny Moore.
It's a bare bones version. We will still get the answer, but it's going to cost us time, years, which is not trivial. Because people are getting infected with this virus constantly.
Despite having to scale back, Moore says HIV vaccine research is farther along than it's ever been. She takes me back into that freezer room in her lab, which contains an embarrassment of scientific riches, thanks in no small part to those 117 women and the samples they've donated over the years.
These samples have taught us everything we know about HIV.
And have revealed a veritable pot of scientific gold, a unique kind of antibody that showed up in the blood of a few of these women, something called a broadly neutralizing antibody.
A broadly neutralizing antibody could stop my virus and could stop your virus and could stop an HIV virus from any other person.
But it's difficult to coax the human immune system to produce these antibodies. This vaccine trial is trying to figure out how to do that more easily. At last, after nearly a year of delays, the pared-down trial is getting underway. On the outskirts of Cape Town, a large brick building rises above Philippi Village, an impoverished township where HIV is rampant. A few levels up, I spot Amelia Mfiki, the community liaison officer for the vaccine trials.
This is a great opportunity for South Africa to prove that we can do things in South Africa for South Africa with South African financing.
Mfiki makes her way to a room where 20 or so young women from the community are gathered to hear about participating in the trial.
HIV vaccine. Now, kumbula kindoba, kukona maglesha po CSET kornoba.
25-year-old Nandipha Mongo listens attentively. She says her community struggles with rape, sex traded for favors, unplanned pregnancies.
Most of us are scared of getting HIV.
Which is why she'd happily be involved in the research.
Yo, I'm over the moon, man. I'm over the moon, yes.
Because she's proud to be making a difference.
Yes, a big one, a big difference.
So I ask her, if this team of researchers are able to find a vaccine, what would a world without HIV be like?
Living free, yeah.
The first shots of the new vaccine trial started going into participants' arms this week. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel, Cape Town, South Africa.
Reporting for this story was supported by a grant from the Pulitzer Center. The Gates Foundation is a financial supporter of NPR.
This is NPR News.
Lucinda Williams once made an album called Sweet Old World. Now she's made an album called World's Gone Wrong.
I mean, I always wanted to be able to write great protest songs like Bob Dylan did.
What Lucinda Williams wants to protest, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. Everybody knows the world's gone wrong.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Some weather-related closures slash cancellations. Bemidji Community Food Shelf will be closed Friday, January 23rd. They'll be open again Monday from 10 to 3. And Northland Arboretum in Brainerd will be closed tomorrow as well. We receive support from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska Federation of Natives is pulling out all the stops to block a Safari Club International proposal to reform the Federal Subsistence Board. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, AFN says it's a direct threat to the Alaska Native subsistence way of life.
Last year, Safari Club International, a sport hunting and fishing group, petitioned two Trump cabinet members for the review. It asked Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins to address what it calls federal overreach in subsistence management. In December, the Interior Department granted the request and announced a 60-day review called a scoping process. During this time, it will consider the Safari Club's recommendations, which includes a proposal to limit the size of the Federal Subsistence Board to only the heads of five federal agencies. Ben Malott, president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, says this would eliminate public seats, including three held by tribal representatives.
We have been working for that for a very long time, so we are concerned that any rollback in public member seats would just weaken our voices. And so for us, that is a major threat.
But beyond changing the leadership structure of subsistence management, the Safari Club calls on federal agency heads when setting regulations to defer to state managers, a move that opponents say would undermine the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA. Legislation Congress passed 45 years ago to protect Alaska's rural subsistence lifestyle. John Sturgeon, a leading advocate for the Alaska Safari Club, says this is a fight about fish and game management, not about the rights of rural Alaskans to subsist.
We have no problem with subsistence. We support it. So it's kind of a perceived conflict because we just think the state of Alaska should be the one that's in charge of subsistence.
The problem is the state's constitution does not allow for a rural subsistence priority, which federal law mandates. Public comment on the Safari Club proposals closes on February 13th. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Indigenous Knowledge Focus Centers are on their way to Spokane Falls Community College and the Spokane Community College campus on the Spokane Reservation in Washington. As Steve Jackson reports, a grant from Avista Utilities is providing the seed money.
The Indigenous Healing Environments Across Lifeways, or IHEAL centers, will hold workshops on skills and concepts related to sustainability of water, land, animals, and climate. They'll also include studies related to using plants for food and medicine. Spokane College's Tribal Relations Director, Naomi Bender, says she will seek out Indigenous presenters from tribes in the region. But she says instructors will be careful in what they present.
Traditional knowledge of plants and medicines, for example, was illegal in the United States. And to this day, we're very careful about what's actually shared and what's not, because people want to monetize and want to harm with what knowledge they gain at times.
Bender says both Indigenous and non-Native students will be welcome at the IHEAL centers. She anticipates they'll begin holding workshops in about a year. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
Congress recently approved more than $13 million in federal funding for the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for fiscal year 2026. This comes after the Trump administration's proposal to eliminate IAIA's federal appropriation. The funding maintains the Institute's current funding level to support academic programs, student services, and general operations. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law. Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A major winter storm is expected to bring heavy snow, freezing rain, and very cold temperatures across the U.S. this weekend, even to southern states like Georgia and Texas. If you are in its path and you're not exactly prepared, do not fear, because Life Kit reporter Andy Tagle chatted with Life Kit host Marielle Segata about making a winter storm checklist.
What supplies should you have on hand when meteorologists are predicting a winter storm?
So the first thing you want to do is start gathering supplies early. Just like any other emergency, you're going to want to have extra food, extra water. You want to have fuel and batteries, any tools you might need for the weather. Power outages are one of the biggest concerns during winter storms. So you want to make sure you have options and backup options for your heat and your light and your cooking. So you want to think about flashlights, matches, candles. When it comes to indoor cooking, you might consider candle warmers, like Sterno's is one option. And you can use those with things like fondue pots. And then you can also have no-cook options, like canned goods and other non-perishables.
Okay. Well, let's talk about prepping your home. What are some of the things you can do ahead of time?
You want to seal your home as much as you can from the elements. So some examples of that, you want to weather strip your doors. You want to insulate your windows. You're just closing gaps from drafts, from snow. You want to insulate your pipes and make sure that they're not cracked. You can wrap them with foam pipe sleeves. You can do that with heat tape or even just old towels and newspaper. If you're planning to not be around your home for a while, you want to make sure to let the faucet leak so that your pipes don't burst. You want to clear your gutters and your downspouts so that there aren't any ice dams or roof leaks, so you don't end up with any dangerous icicles and things like that that can fall on people.
What if you're a renter, though?
Yeah, I also asked that question. It's a good question. I talked with disaster management expert Alyssa Provencio. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Central Oklahoma. Here's what she told me.
It doesn't hurt to have a conversation with your landlord if you're able to and understand what they will take care of and what you are responsible for.
Alyssa says even if you don't own a space, if you have the means and the time, it's a good idea to get extra supplies. So a shovel, salt, snow blowers, and do what you can. So, for example, she says salting sidewalks and driveways isn't something you necessarily could or should wait for a landlord for. It's easy to do and an easy way to help yourself get in and out.
Okay. And if you've never done this before, roundabout how much salt should you be using?
So guidance from the Salt Smart Initiative says about a coffee's cup worth of salt spread evenly is enough for about 500 square feet of driveway. That's about 10 sidewalk squares of driveway. The best time to salt is after you shovel, but before a big storm hits. And a little goes a long way. And then I have one last important note for you when it comes to prepping your home. Home fires and carbon monoxide poisoning are two of the most common hazards that result from winter storms. So it's really important to make sure your furnace has been serviced and your chimney is clean. You want to make sure your carbon monoxide and fire alarms are working before that big storm comes in. You want to remember the rule of thumb. When you're getting cold, you want to keep a 3-foot perimeter around any space heaters.
And then what if your heat goes out?
Yeah, that could be a scary situation. So you never want to use a generator or a camp stove inside or even anywhere partially enclosed. In fact, you want to keep it away from doors, from windows and vents that could allow carbon monoxide to come indoors. You can call 211 in any part of the country for assistance finding warming shelters. Many states activate emergency shelters once the temperatures drop to a certain level. You can also search for your city or your county plus warming shelter online, and that's usually a good place to start.
All right, Life Kit reporter Andy Tagle, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marielle.
And NPR's Life Kit has more tips about emergency preparedness. You can find them at npr.org/lifekit.
The Sundance Film Festival begins today for the last time in Park City, Utah. Next year, it heads to Boulder, Colorado. NPR's Mandalay Del Barco has been attending the festival for more than a decade, and she brings us a preview of what filmmakers and cinephiles will be treated to this year.
On Friday, Sundance will host a gala to honor Robert Redford, the late actor and director who co-founded the Sundance Institute in 1978 and created the Festival of Independent Films. Redford died of natural causes in September at age 89. Eugene Hernandez is the festival's director.
Before he passed earlier this year, he shared with us this quote, "Everybody has a story." And this notion is such a great framing for a festival that has always been about finding and sharing with audiences the stories that will come from all over the world.
For Sundance's finale in Park City, the festival will screen some films that got their starts there, including the 2006 film Little Miss Sunshine, which went on to an Oscar Best Picture nomination. Sundance is also screening a remastered print of the 1969 movie Downhill Racer, in which Redford plays a champion skier.
What's he do it for?
Well, I'll be famous. I'll be a champion.
Sundance senior programmer John Nine says Redford was also a producer on this indie film.
He would tell this story year after year about getting Downhill Racer made. It was a story that was important to him. It became a way that he understood the notion of protecting independence and protecting the artistic voice of a film. So he often used that when he talked to emerging filmmakers to relate to the struggles that they had in getting their films made the way that they wanted to.
Nine says 40% of this year's festival's program came from first-time filmmakers. One whose career Sundance supported is Rachel Lambert, who says she was inspired by a film Redford directed, Ordinary People.
It's a profound legacy a single human being can leave an entire nation's culture. It's remarkable.
Lambert is premiering her newest film, Carousel, a love story starring Chris Pine and Jenny Slate. Also showing at Sundance, documentaries about Chicano theater pioneer Luis Valdez, singer Courtney Love, tennis star Billie Jean King, and South African leader Nelson Mandela.
You're found, you know, the ability of the human spirit to resist injustice right inside prison.
Among the features in competition is The Gallerist with Natalie Portman and Jenna Ortega, and The Invite with Olivia Wilde, Seth Rogen, Penelope Cruz, and Edward Norton. The Invite's producer, David Permit, has been faithfully attending Sundance since the late 1980s, when he was in the audience for Steven Soderbergh's breakout, Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
I never miss Sundance. I've been going every year since. I'm not in and out like a lot of people from Hollywood when they're there with their film. They're in and out for a few days.
Permit showed his first film at Sundance, Three of Hearts, in 1993. Last year, his film Twinless won the festival's Audience Award.
I have 57 movies I want to see in Sundance this coming Sundance. For me, it's about discovery.
Some filmmakers have gone to great lengths to get their work screened this year, including the Iranian film The Friend's House is Here. The drama, set in Tehran's underground art scene, was shot under the radar of Iranian authorities. Amid the country's political turmoil, two of the film's crew members had to drive for 11 hours to smuggle the film over the Turkish border to get it to the festival. According to the film's publicist, the two main actresses were not heard from for weeks during Iran's recent unrest. He says the women are now safe, but the United States denied them visas to attend the Sundance Film Festival. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Department of Defense announced that it's taking greater control over the newspaper Stars and Stripes. Supporters say the change threatens the paper's hard-won independence, which was granted by Congress more than 30 years ago. From WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia, Steve Walsh has this story.
The staff at the military paper is waiting for answers after the Department of Defense announced last week on X that the Pentagon was taking a greater stake in the paper, eliminating so-called woke distractions.
It's hard for me to say what we'll be able to do.
That's Eric Slavin, the paper's editor-in-chief. The Pentagon has referred his staff to the social media post.
From what has been printed so far, yeah, I'm concerned. that stories that are not favorable to the administration in every which way will not be able to be done.
Stars and Stripes won a Polk Award in 2010 for revealing that the Pentagon was secretly profiling journalists before allowing them to embed with troops in Afghanistan. But the paper's bread and butter are more recent stories that show military families struggling to afford off-base housing in Poland, military families stationed in Italy needing food stamps, and a sexual assault case at Fort Bragg, Slavin says.
If a reporter can't investigate claims and talk with the commands, service members are going to lose something. They're going to lose an important forum.
In his post, Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell says Stars and Stripes will focus on warfighting, weapons systems, fitness, and lethality. The Defense Department funds roughly half of the Stars and Stripes budget. Reporters and editors are civilian staff at the Defense Department, though after the first Gulf War in the early 1990s, Congress mandated the paper remain independent. Lawmakers created an ombudsman that reports directly to them, says the paper's current ombudsman, Jacqueline Smith. She is working on a report to lawmakers.
The military community and veterans have to be able to trust that what they're reading is unfiltered. It is not from a public relations viewpoint. It does not have a spin. It is from trained journalists who are giving a balanced report. And Stripes does that. I monitor it every day.
Stars and Stripes started in the Civil War. It was revived in World War I, brought back during World War II, and has been published ever since. The first Trump administration nearly shut it down. In 2020, then-Secretary of Defense Mark Esper cut the paper from the Pentagon's budget. After a bipartisan outcry, the decision was reversed after President Trump tweeted the paper should stay open. Robert Reed was the paper's senior managing editor at the time. He says this effort feels different.
This is a planned strategy developed over a period of time by very knowledgeable lawyers who have found a far more solid legal basis for dealing with Stars and Stripes than Secretary Esper did.
The Office of the Secretary of Defense did not respond to our request for comment. It also comes after a number of moves, including forcing the press corps to sign a pledge that led to nearly all of the traditional press corps to leave the Pentagon in November, says Denny Watkins, a former Navy officer who teaches journalism at Elmhurst University.
It does seem to be all part of a concerted and multi-pronged attack against independent news reporting in the United States.
Having been a part of the target audience, Watkins says the real losers will be the troops who no longer have a real newspaper of their own. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. The National Weather Service suggests for extreme cold warnings, dress in layers, including a hat, face mask, and gloves if you must go outside. Make frequent checks on older family, friends, and neighbors. Ensure portable heaters are used correctly. Do not use generators or grills inside. Use caution while traveling outside. Wear appropriate clothing, a hat, and gloves. And be kind. We receive support from Sanford Bemidji Family Medicine Team, providing care to the whole family from birth to the golden years. More at bemidji.sanfordhealth.org. Itasca Life Options presents a dance and movement showcase tomorrow at noon in the Ives Theater at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. See six unique dances. RSVP through Itasca Life Options Facebook page. Central Lakes College Performing Arts Center presents a free staged reading of The Pillow Man, a dramatic play Friday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. in the Dryden Theater on the Brainerd campus. Intended for audiences 18+, tickets are free, but should be reserved at clcperformingarts.com. Brainerd Nordic Ski Club's Lumberjack Jaunt has been rescheduled for Sunday, February 1st at Northland Arboretum. Choose from Skate or Classic with distances of 6 or 16 kilometers. A free kids race is also offered. Find more info and register at BrainerdNordicSkiClub.com. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids has monthly support groups for caregivers at various times and locations. Find a full schedule at ElderCircle.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Trump administration officials this morning announced the arrests of at least three people who staged a demonstration inside a church in St. Paul, Minnesota last Sunday, where one of the pastors is a local ICE official. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem characterized the incident as a riot, and some of those demonstrators now face federal felony charges. Here to bring us the latest is Matt Sepik with Minnesota Public Radio. Hi.
Hi there.
Matt, tell us more about the people taken into custody today.
Federal agents arrested three people, William Kelly, Chantel Allen, and Nakima Levy Armstrong. Allen is a St. Paul school board member and longtime Black Lives Matter activist. Levy Armstrong is a Christian pastor and a civil rights attorney. At the Sunday protest, Levy Armstrong said it was outrageous that City's church would have David Easterwood, a local ICE leader, according to court documents, on its ministry team.
So someone who claims to worship God, teaching people in this church about God, is out there overseeing ICE agents.
As you can hear in this clip from independent journalist Georgia Fort, the protest was loud and disruptive. Easterwood did not appear to be in church that day, but another pastor turned up the music in an attempt to drown out the demonstrators. But they did not damage any property or hurt anyone.
Matt, what charges are they facing?
Well, only Levy Armstrong and Allen made their first appearances in court today. At the hearing, Assistant U.S. Attorneys Rob Keenan and Orlando Sanza from the Justice Department said the defendants are charged with conspiracy against civil rights for depriving the church members of their First Amendment freedom to worship. I've covered many initial appearances in federal court here, and I have never seen anything like what happened today. Magistrate Judge Doug Mikko asked to see the arrest warrants that are the basis of the criminal complaints, but Keenan and Sanza were not prepared. The judge called a brief recess while the prosecutors found the paperwork.
In the meantime, what about the activists? Are they being held in jail currently?
Yes, for now. Prosecutors Keenan and Sanza argued that the demonstrators committed a violent crime because the parishioners feared for their safety, therefore they shouldn't be released from jail. To back this claim, they said a fleeing parishioner slipped on the icy pavement and broke her arm. Mikko rejected the government's motion to detain Levy Armstrong and Allen, as well as a request to have the two post $10,000 cash bail. In yet another unusual move, prosecutors appealed Mikko's release order to another judge. That means Levy Armstrong and Allen were not freed right away. Levy Armstrong's lawyer, Jordan Kushner, calls the prosecution a purely political move.
This is fascism right at work right now. Where you go to jail in prison because you exercise your First Amendment right to criticize the government.
And the White House today released doctored images on social media of Levy Armstrong crying as agents arrested her. Kushner said he was there when she was arrested and his client was not crying.
There was also an incident yesterday that's drawn even more criticism of ICE. School officials say federal agents used a 5-year-old boy as bait to apprehend undocumented immigrants that were reportedly living at his home. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the suburban Columbia Heights School District says agents detained Liam Conejo Ramos, who was, as you said, 5 years old. School officials say masked agents apprehended Liam in his driveway as he returned home from school with his dad. They say one agent took the child out of the car, led him to the door, and directed him to knock to see if anybody else was home. ICE soon took the father and child away. Mm-hmm. DHS says they are being detained in Texas. Okay. On social media, the Department of Homeland Security says ICE has never, quote, used a child as bait.
And thank you so much, Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio.
You're welcome.
Okay, with America so polarized, swing voters, meaning those who shift between parties and candidates, are key for determining who wins elections. For a little insight into how some swing voters are viewing the first year of President Trump's second term, we're joined now by NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson, who observed a unique focus group. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay, so tell us about what made this focus group so interesting to you.
Well, first of all, a focus group is not a poll. It's not a statistically significant sample, but it can provide a lot of information on the why voters feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. So we have a focus group of 14 voters, all from Pennsylvania. They voted for Joe Biden in 2020, then swung to Donald Trump in 2024. And this is part of NPR's Swing Voter Project. And it's conducted by two research firms, Engages and Sago. NPR is the media partner. And these focus groups are going to occur monthly, so we're going to be bringing you these insights every month.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so the 14 voters, do we know their political leanings?
Yes, they are right-leaning, more identify as Republicans and independents than Democrats. But one thing they have all in common is they take a very dim view of both major parties. They were asked to use one word to describe each party. Here's what they had to say about Republicans.
Trump.
Weak.
Conservative.
Bewildered.
Outspoken.
Patriotic.
Loyal.
Immoral.
And here's what they said about Democrats.
Distracted.
Unprepared.
Panicked.
Sensitive.
Whiny.
Scary.
Disoriented.
Corrupt.
Weak.
So even though most independent voters actually align with one party or the other, their displeasure with both parties are why they move back and forth.
Clearly. Okay. These voters, I understand, were asked a lot of topics in the news, like immigration, Venezuela, Greenland. You listened in. Was there a main takeaway for you?
My main takeaway was these voters have not abandoned Trump altogether, but they want him to focus less on foreign affairs and more on the economy. And more importantly, they feel like all the action with Venezuela and Greenland is chaotic, and it's making them economically anxious. Here's one voter, Grace, only used her first name. And in this clip, you can hear the moderator of the focus group, Rich Tao.
When the invasion occurred with Venezuela, no one in America had any idea that that was going to happen. We just turned on the news. They went in darkness and it just happened. So now I feel like, what's next? I have this feeling of, I don't know what's going to happen next.
And that's causing economic anxiety for you.
Correct.
Now, the White House says Trump is going to talk more about the economy. He's going to take weekly trips, but they haven't always been able to get him to focus on that. Voters in our group were frustrated. They said Trump was too focused on Greenland and Venezuela and not getting the Nobel Peace Prize. And even voters who see some good things happening are still unsatisfied, like Kimberly, who's an independent from Philadelphia.
Aside from gas being down, aside from the border being closed, those are two great things. But I really don't see the president speaking to working individuals.
So you're going to hear that message from Democrats.
Okay. Well, given some of the critical comments we've just heard, were any of the participants regretting their vote?
Very, very few. 8 out of the 14 said they disapprove of Trump's job performance, but only 2 voters said they would vote for Harris if there was a do-over. So what we're going to be watching over the next 10 months is how these mixed feelings shape the midterms. Trump is not on the ballot, but Republicans are, and views of Trump will shape voter choices.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you so much, Mara.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at HUGHydronics.com. Itasca Waters has a special Practical Water Wisdom webinar Thursday, January 29th at noon with Sarah Elliott. Explore how wildfires are affecting the health of water. Register at itascawaters.org. Weather tonight, partly cloudy with chance of flurries. Lows 27 below to 31 below. Northwest winds 10 to 25 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny and cold with daytime highs 11 to 16 below. Evening lows 27 to 34 below.
President Trump is suing J.P. Morgan.